All right, so today I want to talk about how you can get certain two-dimensional complex surfaces, so-called Kummer surfaces, from other objects which are rational elliptic surfaces. In physics they are called Seebeck-Witten curves, and that might be interesting for several reasons. One is that getting Kummer surfaces from these Seebeck-Witten curves gives you a very close relation between the geometric data on this side, which describes Seebeck-Witten curves, and the geometric data on this side. So for example, if I compute what physicists call the Yukawa coupling on both sides, what mathematicians would call the holomorphic cubic form, they are essentially equal. So the plan of the talk is the following. First, I want to remind you very briefly of curves, about curves of genus 1 and 2 and how they are determined. Then I want to remind you of what these elliptic surfaces are over CP1 I'm talking about. And then finally, I want to show you the construction, how you get the Kummer surfaces. All right, so let's start with curves of genus 1 and 2. So in genus 1, we call a curve an elliptic curve. It's a smooth projective variety of genus 1, and I also have a base point on that curve. And the analytic way of thinking about curves of genus 1 is as complex tori, one-dimensional complex tori. So I think of it as the complex plane modded by a rank 2 lattice, which I can normalize so that z plus tau z, where tau is my modular parameter in the upper half plane. So that's how you think of elliptic curves from an analytical point of view. From an algebraic point of view, you would say an elliptic curve is a cubic, a smooth cubic in P2, and you can write such a smooth cubic in the Weierstrass form. Where for us right now n, b are certain complex numbers. And I emphasized up here, on an elliptic curve you have a fixed base point. The fixed base point in this picture would be the point at infinity. And then you know from Bezout's theorem that if you intersect such a curve with the line, it generically has three fixed points. And that fact allows you to define a group structure on an elliptic curve by saying that if I have these three intersection points, the group law is given by the fact that they add up to zero. Now you see, if I remember that the base point is the point at infinity, you see I can have torsion points. So for example, the two torsion points would be this point here, and then if I apply this group law, you see that these add up to zero, counted with multiplicity, where this point is the base point at infinity. All right, so that's how you describe elliptic curves in the Weierstrass form. And what I said in the beginning is it's a smooth cubic. So how do you check whether it's smooth? Well, you compute the discriminant, which is 4a cubed plus 27b squared. And as long as this one is not equal to zero, this is smooth. And you now you can also ask, how does the curve degenerate when you allow the discriminant to go to zero? The two things that can happen essentially is you can have a node. So imagine the torus to degenerate by making one cycle smaller and smaller until it's just a sphere where the north pole and the south pole touch. That's exactly this point here. That's what a node is. And then you can have a cusp as well. We'll come back to this description in a little while. Now, I wanted to say how I can check in these two pictures whether two curves are isomorphic. So, two curves are, elliptic curves are isomorphic. In the first analytical picture, that's the case exactly if the two lattices defining the one-dimensional complex torus are homothetic. So if there is a complex number such that I get the second lattice out of the first. In the second picture, it's not hard to see either. The only thing you have to realize is that the only freedom you have in writing down a Weierstrass equation like this is a reparametrization of y and x. So if I send y to yu cube and x to xu square, what happens to the numbers a and b? The numbers a and b are sent to a over u to the fourth and b to u to the sixth. And now you see out of a, b and the discriminant d, I can form the j invariant, which is a cube over d. Maybe up to a number here, 4. And you see, under this reparametrization, j remains invariant. And so in the second picture, you see that two elliptic curves, at least over the complex numbers, are isomorphic exactly if the j invariants agree. All right, so there's one more very basic construction on curves of genus 1 you can do, which is very essential for the understanding of Seebeck-Witten curves and and also K3 surfaces, which is called a two-isogeny. So if I have my Weierstrass vibration over C, I can certainly shift x so that I can remove the constant term. So if I write the elliptic curve like this, you see that the point of order 2 is quite obvious in this picture. It's simply the point with coordinates y and x equal to 0, 0. Because I removed the constant term, this is a trivial solution to it. So if this is an elliptic curve and I found this two torsion point, what can I do? So if this is my elliptic curve imagined as a complex one-dimensional torus, what can I do? I can identify all the points which are related by a translation of the two torsion point. So I go from here to identifying this part with this part. So now I end up with an elliptic curve which looks like this. And I can actually write down what happens in terms of the Weierstrass vibration. I just replace this Weierstrass vibration by this one. And you see, if I think of these elliptic curves in terms of one-dimensional complex toroid, this would have a modular parameter tau, and this one would have a modular parameter tau over 2. So that's a 2 isogeny. And now let's just do one more thing. Over the complex number, if I assume that this q is not equal to 0, I can scale it away. So then, by rescaling x and y, so then I get, in the first case, the curve and the two isogenous curves would be and this, the first one, is called the Seebeck-Witten curve for n equals 2 SU2 gauge theory with no hypermultiplets. And the second one is called the Seebeck-Witten curve with two massless hypers. So this is how these Seebeck-Witten curves arise, and you see, just having a good understanding of elliptic curves, you can write down what they are. We'll modify this picture in a little bit though. Alright, now let me briefly mention what happens in case of genus 2. So every curve of genus 2 is hyperelliptic, which means you can write it down in the following form: y squared equals f of x, where f is a sextic. And now the hyperelliptic involution in here is simply sending y to minus y. Alright, then for such a sextic, you can define the so-called Igusa-Clebsch coefficients. There are 4 of them, usually denoted by I2, I4, I6, and I10. And what's the relevance of that? Well, let's say now I have this genus 2 curve, and I have an isomorphic genus 2 curve. In terms of the roots of this sextic, that means that the roots of one sextic are obtained from the roots of the other sextic by a linear transformation. So now I have these isomorphic genus 2 curves. Then it's a theorem by Clebsch and Bolzano. This is exactly the case if and only if there's a complex number such that you get the Igusa-Clebsch coefficient of one sextic out of the Igusa-Clebsch coefficient of the other sextic by a simple rescaling. So you see, these invariants here, you should actually think of them as coordinates on a weighted projective space. And these are the weights, 2, 4, 6, 10. And each point in this weighted projective space describes an equivalence class of sextic of equivalent sextic. By the way, these Igula coefficients, if I start writing down the sextic as a polynomial in X, these are simply polynomials with integer coefficients in these coefficients of the sextic. All right, and what you should think of these Igusa-Krebsch coefficients as the analogs of A and B in the genus 1 case. And now what you can do, you can form absolute invariants ones which don't scale. What this means in terms of this weighted projective space, you pick a particular coordinate chart where you set this coordinate equal to 1, and then you get 3 absolute invariants and you should think of these absolute invariants as the analog of the J invariant in the genus 1 case. All right, that's what I wanted to say about curves of genus 1 and 2. Now let's move on to elliptic surfaces. Yeah?
What kind of projective space is that?
It's the weighted projective 3 space where you have certain weights on the coordinates. That's the definition of it.
So G equals 2 curves are in 1-to-1 correspondence with WP3?
Equivalence classes of curves.
Equivalence classes, right.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah,
so no other identity. It's exactly
no.
That.
Yeah, that's over an algebraically closed field like C. All right. So now let's move on to the second point. The second point was elliptic surfaces. So now what you want to do is vary an elliptic curve in a one-parameter family. And that you do in the following way. So on a complex two-dimensional surface, you say this carries an elliptic vibration if there is a holomorphic projection map from this complex two-dimensional surface to a base curve, C, such that the generic fiber is an elliptic curve. And for us, we will mostly look at the case, or almost exclusively look at the case where this base curve is CP1. All right. Now you can ask, does this vibration actually have sections? So a holomorphic map from the curve up to the elliptic surface, let's call it sigma, so that if I go back to the base curve, I get 1. And if you have at least such a section, you call this elliptic vibration a Jacobian elliptic vibration. And what you think of this one section you have at least as giving you a base point in each fiber. And as the section varies over the base in each fiber, which is an elliptic curve, you get a base point. So now you can write this as a Weierstrass equation again, as before. However, now AB are not complex numbers anymore. They are now in the function field of the base curve. So the first thing which puzzled me when I learned about this was, once I've given this Weierstrass vibration, how do I actually go back to getting my surface, my complex two-dimensional surface? And that's really at the root of how you classify these vibrations. So what you can do is the following. First, look at all the base points where the discriminant, remember the discriminant was 4a cubed plus 27b, where the discriminant is not equal to zero. So just look at the points where the discriminant is not equal to zero. And you know, over each such point, the elliptic curve is smooth. So at these points, we don't have any problems. We get a smooth total space, a smooth projection, and so on. And now you have to think about what you fill in suitable fibers at the singular points. At, let's say, points where delta is equal to, or d is equal to zero, where the discriminant is equal to zero. And there you have to distinguish between the two cases. So even though at the point, at the points where the discriminant is equal to zero, the fiber becomes singular, that doesn't mean that the surface defined by this equation becomes singular. So if surface is smooth, what that means is that the fiber is irreducible. It's just a CP1, not quite. The two cases which can happen is that it's either a node or a cusp, the things I showed you before. The other thing which can happen is that the surface actually has a surface singularity at this point. And then what you have to do is take the minimal resolution and then the fiber is reducible, but it turns out that all components, all irreducible components, components are smooth rational curves. Of self-intersection minus 2. So, and you can classify these singularities, which you get from a Weierstrass equation like this. And Kodaira did this in the 50s. Classified singularities, and they are classified by the local monodromy of your elliptic vibration, and you can rephrase that in terms of the local behavior of these functions A, B, and the discriminant D. Yeah. So I have this equation here,
and it's not just
It's a complex two-dimensional surface, right? Given by this equation, I have one variable here. So these are functions on the base curve, and then this parameterizes the fiber, so I get a complex two-dimensional surface if I write it down as a Weierstrass vibration like this. But this surface has singularities or not. It certainly has singular fibers, but just having a singular fiber doesn't mean that the partials with respect to y and x also vanish. This is why surface singularity is not equal to singular fiber. Alright, so he classified that, and so the appearance of a node is called, in his classification, a fiber of type 1-1. The cusp is called a fiber of type 2, and these reducible singular fibers are classified into two groups. The first group are two infinite series, one called 1n, where n is now bigger than 2, and 1n star, where n is bigger than 0. And the second group are the exceptional cases, which are called 3, 4, 2 star, 3 star, 4 star. But as I said, the good thing is they are completely described, encoded in terms of the vanishing degree of these coefficient functions A, B, and the discriminant D at these singular points. So hold on, I just want to see that I'm not forgetting anything. Okay, so this is the classification result. Hope you can see that. Maybe I turn off the light just for a second. So you see exactly these notation which I listed on the blackboard appear there. So here you have the singular fiber of type 1-1. That's a node. That's exactly what this picture is. Here's 1n. Here are the stars. 2, 3, 4, 4 star, 3 star, 2 star. You see 2 as a cusp, exactly as I said. How do you read such a diagram? Each of these lines is just a CP1. With self-intersection minus 2, and the number here is just the multiplicity of that component in the fiber. So for example, for I0 star, the central component has multiplicity 2, and all of these are CP1s, and you can read off what kind of singularity you have in your Weierstrass vibration exactly from these numbers. These are the vanishing degrees of these coefficient functions A, B, and the discriminant. So for example, you see at a singular singularity of type 1n, both A and B are not allowed to vanish, and only the discriminant has a zero of degree n. This is how you read this chart. All right. That was, by the way, taken from a really nice paper written by Rick Miranda. I can give you the reference if you like. All right, so one thing we saw, which you probably don't remember now, but that the list terminates as soon as the vanishing degree of A gets bigger than 4 and of B and at the same time at B gets bigger than 6. You'll see that was actually the case before, was just 1 degree lower, was exactly the last case on this transparency. And why is that? The reason is that if you have a singular point where the vanishing degrees of A and B are bigger than 4 and 6, you can twist this zero away. Remember, I can write a reparametrization of my Weierstrass equation by mapping x to xt squared, y to yt cubed. And what that means in terms of A and B is that A is mapped to A over t to the 4, and B is mapped to B over t to the 6. So if these zeros gets too big, you can just absorb them in a redefinition of x and y. And this process is called minimalizing your Weierstrass equation. Now, one last point about this classification result. I also showed you what the J invariant is for elliptic curves, and the J invariant classified the elliptic curves. Now we have families of elliptic curves, so the J invariant now becomes a function on the base curve, and you can ask, does that classify the Jacobian elliptic vibration? And the answer is almost. The only freedom you have is what is called the quadratic twist. So you see, if I replace A by A over t squared and B over replaced by B over t cubed, such a transformation I cannot absorb in a reparametrization of x and y, because then I would have to introduce a square root here. But still, if you carry out this transformation, you see that the J invariant stays the same, because it just scales out. So you see, a Jacobian elliptic vibration has a unique J invariant up to the quadratic twist. And what does the quadratic twist do? It maps exactly these singularities of 1n and 1n star into each other, and 3 into 3 star, and then 2 and 4 star are mapped into each other, and 4 and 2 star. All right, now the elliptic surfaces we care about, or I care about, I should say, are the ones where the base curve is CP1. And in this case, you have a globally minimalized Weierstrass equation, and what that means is that if I write the coordinates on CP1 as U and V, A, B, and the discriminant are homogeneous polynomials in U and V of degree 4n, degree 6n, and degree 12n. And so now you can go through the list of n's. You see, in the case n equals to 0, what am I saying? I'm saying that all these coefficients are constant. So what is the elliptic vibration I'm getting? The elliptic vibration is simply if the curve crosses the base. In case I set n equal to 1 in this equation, I get what is called a rational elliptic surface. And in physics, there's a slightly different notation used. It's sometimes called 1/2 k3. I don't know whether this is the best notation, but anyways. And then for n equals 2, you get what is called elliptic k3 surfaces. And for n bigger than 1, you get something which are called truly elliptic. No, honestly, I think. Honestly, elliptic surfaces. The ones we care about are exactly the case where n is equal 1 or 2. And let me just go through these cases. What time is it? Okay. Case n equals 1, it's a theorem that any rational elliptic surface is CP2 blown up at 9 points. And we have already seen examples in this talk of rational elliptic surfaces. So instead of using these projective coordinates, let me use a coordinate chart, little u1, so that little u is equal to capital U divided by v. And then if I take this as the parameter on my CP1, I've already shown you two rational elliptic surfaces. These were the Seebeck-Witten curves. So I wrote down the NF equals 0 Seebeck-Witten curve, which was given as this equation. Back then, we thought of this U as just a complex number, but now we think of it as the coordinate on our base space. And there's also the NF equals 2 Seebeck-Witten curve, which I just showed you a few minutes ago, was this. So now let's look at it from the standpoint of elliptic surfaces. So now you can ask, what are the singular fibers in this Weierstrass vibration? And you can easily compute it. This one has two singular fibers of type 1-1 at u equals minus 1 and u equals plus 1. And one singular fiber of type I4 star at u equals infinity. The other one, the two isogenous one, has two singularities of type I2 and one of type I2 star at u equals minus 1, u equals plus 1, and u equals infinity. And in fact, a Seebeck-Witten curve for NF hypermultiplets is supposed to have a singular fiber at infinity of type 1, 4 minus NF star. That is a physical condition which comes from the fact that the fiber at infinity has to match the low energy behavior of your gauge theory in the weak coupling limit. So this is why these singular fibers are really the defining properties of these Seebeck-Witten curves. Now, just as an illustration, I told you that you can always carry out a quadratic twist. So what you could do in this case here, carry out a quadratic twist, let's say around this singular fiber. So you would send A to u minus 1 squared a and b to u minus 1 cube b, and then you would get another vibration, and you see what happens here, this singularity remains untouched, and here I exchange this singularity with an I1 star singularity. But you see, now for big U, I also change the behavior at infinity. So now at infinity, I simply get an I4 singularity. This process, when you twist and you put one star from here to here, is sometimes called to move the star from one singular fiber to another. And now you see, here we have another Seebeck-Witten curve, one with an I1 star singularity, and that is in fact the NF equals 3 Seebeck-Witten curve with 3 massless hypermultiplets. And you also see, fiber-wise, how did we construct these two elliptic surfaces? By 2 isogeny, right? Each of these elliptic curves was constructed by 2 isogeny, and you can think of this as a birational map between these two elliptic surfaces. It's not a map between elliptic surfaces, because if you construct this 2 isogeny, it doesn't keep the zero section fixed. So here you see we have already 3 Seebeck-Witten curves. There are more, of course, but you see they arise in this very interesting context of rational elliptic surfaces. Now I want to move on to the K3 surfaces. Any questions so far? All right. So for the K3 surfaces, now you make A and B polynomials of degree 8 and 12 respectively. So these are called the elliptic K3 surfaces. And you see, for example, from the universal bundle formula, in this context, that the canonical bundle of these is trivial, as you expect for a K3 surface. Within these K3 surfaces, and that appeared in the title, there are very special K3 surfaces, which are called the Kummer surfaces. And they arise in the following way. So now think about of A as being an abelian surface. So now this A has an abelian group structure, and you can ask what are the fixed points under minus the identity. Turns out that there are 16 fixed points, and when you divide by the action of this, you get 16 rational double points. And now, when you take the minimal resolution of these singularities, you get another K3 surface, which is called the Kummer surface. So, what are examples of abelian surfaces? There are 2 examples which are of special importance for us. First one is where this is simply the product of 2 elliptic curves, and the second one is where it's the Jacobian of an elliptic of a hyperelliptic genus 2 curve. So for both, in both of these cases, you can carry out the Kumma construction. Let me just say a little bit about this, and then even less about this, and then move on. So let's say in here, we have these two elliptic curves described by equations, these two Weierstrass equations. And now, how do I construct the function field on Y, the Kumma surface of A? Well, it is going to be a subfield given in these four variables, x1, x2, y1, and y2. But I have to take the subfield, which is invariant under the action of this reflection here of minus the identity. How does this act on these variables? Well, it actually maps xi to xi and yi to minus yi. So as good variables, I can take x1, x2, and y1 times y2. So now these three are invariant. But there's one relation which comes from these two Weierstrass equations. The one equation you get is t squared equal to fx1, fx2. And now you can actually show that this equation, which now describes the Kumma surface in P3, can be written as a quartic, and that is sometimes called the Inouye quartic. And you see on this Kumma surface, you have various elliptic vibrations. So for example, in here, I could just take the projection on x1. I would say x1 is the coordinate of my base space. That would give me an elliptic vibration on this Kumma surface. If you do the math, you'll see this one will have four singular fibers of type I0 star or 1-0 star. And Urguizo classified all the possible elliptic vibrations you can have of this on this Kumma surface, which is the Kumma of a product of non-isogenous elliptic curves, and there are 11 elliptic vibrations, different elliptic vibrations. And what that means is that when you finally write down the Weierstrass equation describing this elliptic vibration, these polynomials A and B, which describe your vibration, their coefficients can be expressed in terms of the J invariants of these elliptic curves. You see that here we have written down the equation of the quartic, and F and G are essentially given by the J invariants of these two elliptic curves. So now you just have to find the right elliptic vibration, and then you can write down what the coefficients of these polynomials are in terms of these J invariants. All right, so you can do a similar thing as I showed you if your abelian surface is the Jacobian of a hyperelliptic curve of genus 2, and then the Kumma model you get is the so-called 16-6 model. So you have 16 singular points, which are nodes, and if you and there are 16 hyper. I always mess that up. So just. Yeah, so there are 16 singular points, we knew that, and in P3 there are also 16 hyperplanes, which are tangent to this quartic, and each of these 16 hyperplanes contains 6 nodes, and each node is contained in 6 hyperplanes. So this is what is called the 16-6 model of a Kummer quartic. And now, in principle, for such a Kummer surface, you can also compute, write down an elliptic vibration on this Kummer surface. And once you have done this, again, you get these functions which define your elliptic vibration, but now the coefficients of these polynomials are expressible in terms of the Igusa invariants. Which I introduced before. All right. Any questions up to this point?
What's the Jacobian of C?
Okay, so you can think of it as, birationally it's the same as you take 2 copies of C and take the part which is invariant under permutation, and that gives you the right function field. And this has singularities, now you have to do something with the singularities. That's the easiest way to think of it in this context. There are other ways too. All right. Now let's tie it all together. That would be the last part. So, let's start with the NF equals 2 Seebeck-Witten curve. And remember, this one had singular fibers of type I2, I2, and I2 star. And if you work out the what A and B and the discriminant is in these cases, you see that the degree of the polynomial in A is 2, in B is 3, and the discriminant is 4. In principle, these numbers could be higher, but because you want singularity of type star at infinity, these have to be of lower degree as the maximal allowed degree for rational elliptic surfaces. And now, what can you do? Remember, this was a singularity at minus 1, 1 at infinity. You take the function, which is simply u minus a, u minus b, u minus c, where a, b, and c are not plus or minus 1 or infinity. And now you just twist this vibration by replacing A by AH square. So you see, this is a polynomial of degree 3, so AH square is now a polynomial of degree 8. You replace B by BH cube, that's now a polynomial of degree 12, and D you replace by DH to the 6th, that's now a polynomial of degree 24. In other words, after carrying out this twist, this is now an elliptic K3 surface. And Now, I didn't really explain this in detail, but as I explained for the Seebeck-Witten curve, you also have the Seebeck-Witten curve for NF equals zero, and one is obtained from the other by a translation of a two torsion point. That is what the two isogeny was. And now you can ask, well, now I can do the same construction here. Once I have this K3 surface, I can take the translation by one of these two torsion sections. And then you get another K3 surface. And then the question you might ask is this new K3 surface Kummer? That's what we originally hoped for, but that turns out to be false. That is actually not true. This one is not Kummer. But then you can modify this construction a little. I'll be done in very soon. You can modify this construction a little bit. So imagine you have an elliptic vibration over a curve C. You can do a base transformation. Let's say and then you can pull back this Weierstrass equation to the other base and you get a new elliptic vibration. And that's what you can try here too. So let me show you the big picture. So again, we start with the two Seebeck-Witten curves. And here we had two singularities of type I1, one singularity of I4 star. Here we have two singularities of I2 and one of I2 star. These were related by two isogeny. And the parameter we used here was this coordinate u, which put these at points minus 1, plus 1, and infinity. Now what you do is a base transformation. You write u as c times s cubed plus as squared plus bs plus c divided over S squared. So this gives you a map from CP1 to CP1, which has local ramifications, but you can now pull back the Weierstrass equation you have here, which is simply the Seebeck-Witten curve, to a Weierstrass vibration here. And what happens? Well, at the unramified points, which are of this map, which are plus and minus 1, nothing really happens. You replace each I1 singularity on this rational elliptic surface by 3, because you have a polynomial of degree 3, by 3 I1s on this side. So you get 6 I1s down here after carrying out this base change, and then you see the point u equals infinity or s equals zero is a point which has a ramification index of 2. So in principle, the vanishing order of A and B at these points is multiplied by 2. But what happens when you carry out the base transformation, this new elliptic vibration is not minimal anymore. You have to minimalize it, and then you end up with a singular with a Weierstrass vibration which has the following singular fibers. And of course, you can carry out the same base transformation over there for the NF equals 2 Seebeck-Witten curve. You get a second K3 surface. And remember, these two were related by isogeny, and actually that works also downstairs for the two K3 surfaces. And finally, you can check that this elliptic K3 surface over here is the Kummer surface of a Jacobian of a hyperelliptic curve of genus 2, which means that these parameters you put in, A, B, and C, are now expressible in terms of the absolute Igusa-Krebsch invariance. Okay, so this is the construction. Just my last remark is, why is that interesting? Well, by carrying out this construction, so you see the K3 surfaces here we get downstairs are related to the Seebeck-Witten curves essentially by a change in base of your elliptic vibration. That means that if you compute geometric data here and here, for example, the period integrals or what the physicists call the Yukawa coupling, they are essentially the same on both levels. On the other hand, because we can relate this K3 surface to this Kummer surface, we can actually express these new parameters we put in terms of the Igusa invariance of this sextic curve. And that's the picture of what I want to tell you today. Thank you. Any questions? That's never a good sign.
The stuff that you, or how does your stuff fit?
Dave and I thought about this more or less by accident. So what we were trying to do was there's this famous piece. Let me just write this down. So there's this K3 surface, also given as an elliptic K3 surfaces, which has singular fibers 6i1 plus i12 star. And this one is related to a Kummer surface, which turns out to be the Kummer surface for a product of two non-isogenous elliptic curves by this 2 isogeny I showed you over there. On the other hand, on this K3 surface, I have a different vibration. which has singular fibers 2 star plus 4 I1. And again, for this one, I get another Kummer surface. And in this picture here, these two K3 surfaces play an important role in the heterodic F-theory duality. So you see here, essentially, the gauge group is E8 plus E8. And here it would be D16 plus, coming from the Psi-12 fiber. And so you see these two are essentially given by the same, by different vibrations on the same K3 surfaces. And what we were trying to do was to generalize this construction. You see, here I have a two-parameter family of K3 surfaces, which essentially are given in terms of the J invariants. And when we write them, and here we had a three-parameter family, which is given in terms where the coefficients are given in terms of these absolute Egusa-Clebsch coefficients. And if you set this A equal to 0, you actually get exactly this case back. Nevertheless, it turned out that this family wasn't really the family we were looking for, but I thought it might still be interesting because this family has a very close relation to the Seiberg-Witten curves. So when you look at it, you learn both something about the Seiberg-Witten curves and K3 surfaces. Any more questions?